is Tuesday, October 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Turkey's president tells his country's parliament that Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi was murdered in a ferocious manner.
He did not attribute direct blame for the killing of Khashoggi to the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman.
U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton meets with Russian officials in Moscow to discuss arms control, and America's oldest restaurant serves seafood and history. It's all ahead. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Tuesday that the killing of U.S.-based Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi was a premeditated act and that all those responsible should be punished. Saudi Arabia admitted last week that Khashoggi died inside its Istanbul consulate, initially saying it happened after a fight, later changing its story to say he died in a chokehold to prevent him from leaving the building. Speaking to the Turkish parliament, Erdogan said Tuesday that Saudi Arabia took an important step by admitting the killing took place, but that he expects the country's leaders to hold all those involved responsible, no matter their rank. The Turkish leader gave details about what happened starting the day before Khashoggi visited the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. He said multiple teams flew to Istanbul to meet Khashoggi at the diplomatic outpost.
Aralarında generallerin de bulunduğu 9 kişilik 3.
He said overall the team we are looking at is a total of 15 people, and this team of people from 9:50 to 11 a.m. they came in different groups to the consulate and met there. Jamal Khashoggi was telephoned at 11:50 to confirm his appointment on that day. On the same day, in the early hours, Khashoggi comes from London to Istanbul and enters on foot into the consulate building at 1:08. Reporter Dorian Jones in Istanbul speaks with me about Erdogan's highly anticipated speech.
President Erdogan sought to tear down Riyadh's narrative of events that Jamal Khashoggi was killed in a fistfight in the Istanbul consulate by accident. President Erdogan, addressing his parliamentary deputies, said that this was a carefully premeditated plan by Riyadh to execute this journalist. He then went on to explain. He said there were three teams involved in the killing, two of them flown in from Riyadh and one made up of members of the Istanbul consulate. He said that this had been carefully planned and then went on to point out that the hard drives of the surveillance cameras at the Istanbul consulate where Khashoggi was killed had been removed. He then chastised Saudi Arabia for its failure to cooperate fully. He said that they are still failing to cooperate, saying that Saudi Arabia's explanation of how they dispose of the body using what they called a collaborator. He said they're still waiting to find out who this person or persons were. So this was a very strong speech against Riyadh. But it has to be said, it could have been a lot worse for Riyadh because there was the expectation he would talk about these tapes and video recordings that leaks from the investigation claim that they have that recorded the last minutes of Khashoggi's life, where investigators say he was tortured, then executed, and then his body dismembered. President Erdogan did not even talk about those tapes. And crucially, he did not attribute direct blame for the killing of Khashoggi to the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman. There was expectations he possibly could. So I think there's quite a lot of relief both in Riyadh and in Washington over this speech.
Yeah, there has been, as you said, a lot of speculation about those tapes. There had been reports that it could have come from Khashoggi's Apple Watch. But then, of course, there were reports that the Saudi consulate in Istanbul had been bugged.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is one possible explanation why Turkey hasn't released these tapes, if they do have them. In fact, U.S. President Donald Trump has alluded to the fact that they may not even exist. And the reason, one possible explanation why they haven't been presented is that it would reveal that the Turkish security forces had been bugging the Istanbul Saudi consulate. Now, that is a complete no-no under international diplomatic law and would be quite embarrassing for the Turkey to admit to this. But having said that, other observers have said that the fact that Turkish security forces have admitted that these tapes do exist underlines that they have already probably compromised the Istanbul consulate. But I think there will be relief that they haven't been released, although the CIA chief, Gina Haspel, has flown into Ankara today to reportedly examine these tapes if they do exist. Now, up until now, the Turkish foreign minister speaking today said that they will not be sharing these tapes with anyone. So there's still a lot of conjecture whether these tapes exist and what's on them.
Yes, and as you also said, Erdogan seemed to be sensitive to offending members of Saudi Arabia's royal family. I've also read that some observers said that he has to be particularly careful not offending the king, never mind the crown prince.
Yeah, that's right. It's quite interesting. He really was very careful in his language, showing a lot of respect to King Salman, who he has been speaking with during this crisis. President Erdogan, it's no secret, has very bad relations with the crown prince, but still has pretty good ties with the king, who he has known for many years. So he again followed this line that he showed a lot of respect there. And this is fueling speculation that there is some possible deal that is in that is slowly being hammered out between Ankara, Riyadh, and possibly Washington as well. Although Ankara has been very clear publicly, they insist that there will be no whitewashing of the investigation. There will be no secret deals. But analysts and people that are close to the presidency have been speculating for some time that some deal is in the offing, that Riyadh will have to pay a very considerably high price for some exit strategy from this diplomatic crisis. One possible concession Riyadh is probably now expected to make is that President Erdogan has called for the 18 people that have been detained by Saudi authorities in connection with the death of Khashoggi, that they should be tried in Turkey. Now, that is a big leap, but that will be a big concession from Riyadh, but this could be the possible first steps in some sort of long-term deal between the two countries to resolve this crisis.
Well, and meanwhile, in Istanbul, apparently Turkish officials continue to look, I guess possibly in the Belgrade forest, maybe other areas, for the remains of Jamal Khashoggi.
Yes, the search is still continuing for the remains of this journalist. This is, of course, very important for his family members and close friends. It does help with closure. But it's also very important for the Turkish investigations to confirm their narrative. All along, they have insisted that Khashoggi was brutally tortured before being killed. And I think that for forensics, this would be very important to prove this case. But they have been struggling. They've been looking in various locations after following the movements of this alleged 15-member Saudi hit team that is blamed for the killing of the journalist. Investigators have been scouring thousands and thousands of hours of CCTV footage following these people. But they still have not found the body. And then this is why there's a lot of criticism of Riyadh. Riyadh has admitted that he did dispose of the body, but Ankara is saying they're not getting cooperation in finding that body. And this is, I think, a point of ongoing tension as the search continues trying to find the remains of Khashoggi.
Dorian Jones reporting from Istanbul. Meanwhile, here in Washington, U.S. Vice President Mike Pence said Erdogan's assessment of the killing underscores the determination of the Trump administration to find out what happened. But Pence said the word from President Erdogan this morning that this brutal murder was premeditated, pre-planned days in advance, flies in the face of earlier assertions that had been made by the Saudi regime. Pence said at an event at the Washington Post that the world is watching. And the Post is where Khashoggi wrote opinion columns that were critical of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who was the country's de facto leader. Pence said the American people want answers, and we will demand that those answers are forthcoming. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Global stocks fall on worries about weak economic growth and profits. In Somalia, inter-clan clashes leave 60 people dead and scores injured. The U.S. and Saudi Arabia issue joint sanctions on Taliban figures. And as the trade war persists, Japanese Prime Minister Abe makes his first visit to China. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new Canadian study suggests that including high-protein milk with breakfast may help those with type 2 diabetes better maintain their blood glucose levels throughout the day, and that it helps the eater feel full. The study, published in the Journal of Dairy Science, also shows that consuming the high-protein milk at lunch helps reduce the eater's appetite compared to those consuming a lower or no-protein product. H. Douglas Goff, who led the team of researchers from the University of Guelph and the University of Toronto, both in Ontario, Canada, says that their study confirms just how important consuming milk at breakfast is in helping to slow the digestion of carbohydrates and maintain lower blood sugar levels. According to the World Health Organization, 425 million people between the ages of 20 and 79 are living with diabetes, with the number predicted to rise to 629 million by 2045. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Illinois voters choose issues over heritage in a congressional race. We'll have a report. Russia's Security Council has indicated it's prepared to work with the United States on addressing American concerns over charges Moscow is violating the 1987 Intermediate Nuclear Forces, or INF, treaty. The offer came as White House National Security Advisor John Bolton met with Russian officials, including President Vladimir Putin, in Moscow. President Donald Trump reaffirmed his intention to pull out of the treaty.
Russia has not adhered to the agreement. This should have been done years ago. Until people come to their senses, we have more money than anybody else by far. We'll build it up until they come to their senses. When they do, then we'll all be smart and we'll all stop.
The Kremlin warned U.S. withdrawal would make the world more dangerous. Spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Russia would have to take action to restore balance if the U.S. develops new short-range and medium-range nuclear systems. John Tierney is executive director of the Washington-based Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, Moscow is likely in violation of the treaty designed in large part to reduce the nuclear threat to Europe.
The contentions that the United States put in during the Obama administration and repeated in this administration are that they've developed a system that does not really pass the muster of the treaty. So they say they're in violation, the Russians deny it, but there's a way to resolve it without pulling out of the treaty, and that would be to go back to the table and negotiate and seek an inspection of the material and see if it violates and have them negotiate a pullback on it and a redesign, redevelopment of it if it does, and work on it that way. And I'm sure that there's plenty to talk about on both sides if they want to try that avenue.
Is this the same ploy the president may have used in the NAFTA trade negotiations with Mexico and Canada, eventually reaching a new agreement?
Well, it might be. I know that's what Bob Corker over in the Senate would like to believe. It's probably not the preferred way of most professional diplomats to proceed and not one that countries are used to. But it seems to be one that this president is willing to try no matter what the subject matter. But right now, if you take it at face value, I think it's a very dangerous prospect of pulling out of that treaty when there's still prospects of putting it together and having it work. It serves benefits to the Europeans as well as to America and Russia and doesn't bode well for things like New START and the extension of New START if they start down the path. And that's an important agreement as well.
Why would the president draw China into this since it's not a party to the treaty?
I can't explain that, man, but I might guess that somebody told him somewhere on the line that China has similar type of weapons that might be banned by the treaty if they were a party to the treaty, and he thought he'd want to try to loop them in. But generally, it's been Russia that's been more concerned with what China has in this arranged than the United States. So whether he's just got it in his mind that somebody mentioned it or whether he thinks he'd like to have a more inclusive agreement covering more than just two countries, he doesn't really explain in his tweet. It's not enough letters for him to deal with, and I'm not sure he comprehends the whole situation.
Russia seems to leave open the possibility of some sort of accommodation. Is that hopeful?
I think it's there. I mean, I think it was there without all of this showboating about pulling out. It was there if people just wanted to go back to the table and start having a conversation. I'm concerned that John Bolton is starting to run the White House when it comes to foreign policy. And, this is a very pliable president who doesn't often seem to have a mind of his own on these matters and is catching up all the time. And John Bolton has a history, is fixated on not liking international agreements and thinking that they serve no national security interests for the United States. So, it should be a concern to everybody that he's in there instead of, as National Security Advisor, pulling together all of the different opinions and views of the various departments. He seems to be setting policy and pushing his president in a direction that could be harmful.
Bolton said the bilateral INF treaty no longer meets today's realities because a number of states possess intermediate and short-range nuclear capability, including North Korea and China. He said in a Russian interview, the next step is consultations with friends in Europe and Asia. In the meantime, Bolton said talks with Russia will continue. The United Nations Refugee Agency has sent dozens of staff to southern Mexico to help stabilize a chaotic situation and screen the asylum claims of many of the thousands of people in a migrant caravan heading towards the United States. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
More than 45 UN refugee staff have arrived in Tapachula in Chiapas State, Mexico, and others are on their way. The UNHCR says conditions on the ground appear to be somewhat calmer and more orderly than in previous days. But UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards says with some 7,000 desperate people on the move, the situation could change at any time.
Of particular concern for us at the moment is the developing humanitarian situation among this group, with many people having food, water, health and other needs. There's also kidnapping and security risks in areas the caravan may venture into. Stabilizing the situation is therefore urgent.
Edward says UNHCR teams are registering asylum seekers, identifying those who are particularly vulnerable with specific needs. He says increasing aid and providing more shelter is essential. He says so far about 1,000 people have sought asylum in Mexico. He adds thousands more are likely to continue on toward the United States. He tells VOA some will be in need of international protection.
All countries have a right to be able to manage their own immigration and manage their own borders. What is important for us is that those borders are managed in an asylum-sensitive way, which means giving people access, assessing their claims, and then dealing with them accordingly in line with international law.
Edward says individuals fleeing persecution and violence must be given access to the country where they are seeking asylum and the right to apply. U.S. President Donald Trump has vowed to prevent the caravan of refugees and migrants from crossing U.S. borders. He has warned foreign aid to Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala will be cut off if they do not stop people from migrating to the United States. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The U.S. midterm elections take place 2 weeks from today. A congressional race in one Illinois district pits two Indian Americans against each other. The Democratic incumbent was born in New Delhi before moving to the United States as an infant. His Republican opponent immigrated to America more than 20 years ago. But both men see the race as a battle between two Americans rather than Indian Americans. VOA's Aisha Sarai reports from Schaumburg, Illinois.
In Illinois' 8th Congressional District, incumbent Democrat Raja Krishnamoorthy is battling to keep his seat in November's high-stakes midterm elections.
Okay, yeah, of course I know.
Republican challenger Jitendra J.D. Digandkar is vying for his seat. Both candidates agree on one thing. The race has nothing to do with their Indian heritage.
And I don't see as an Indian versus Indian race. I see as an American versus American.
Both candidates have focused on the issues and say their community has too.
The fact that, you know, someone whose name probably 90% of the voters can't pronounce is their member of Congress speaks so highly of my constituents.
Yeah, our state senator is from Mexico. Our state representative is from Puerto Rico. Our junior senator is Thai background. So what it says about us is we vote by the type of person and what that person can do and not anything else.
It's always something.
Supporters for the Republican candidate agree.
It shows the changing demographics of America. And part of the reason that, you know, I think J.D. and I are drawn to the Republican Party is that it doesn't necessarily judge you based on your skin color.
Voters in this Midwestern state's 8th district say policies top their concerns.
I think what's more important is their views and their policy. I mean that doesn't really matter to me, you know, what their minority is.
I don't care about them being Indian American. I just hope that whichever one wins, that they support and they help the people.
We should go for the people who more care about you and your community. It's not about race, I think. Hindu or Muslim doesn't matter.
Come November, voters of the Illinois 8th say they will choose between the two American candidates based on their platforms. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Schaumburg, Illinois.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hey, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. There are more than 650,000 restaurants in the United States, enough to satisfy the pickiest eater. New venues open every day, yet staying in business with such tremendous competition is no easy task. One restaurant has been able to stay open for nearly 200 years. Karina Bafragian takes us to an oyster house in Boston, Massachusetts, that stakes its claim as the oldest restaurant in the U.S.
Boston has a storied past as part of the birth of American democracy. And its restaurants belong to Boston's long history, including one that was listed as a National Historical Landmark in 2003. That's the Union Oyster House. It has been feeding Bostonians and tourists for almost two centuries. The restaurant's signboard might have lost its luster, but chef Rico Di Fronzo says the place is packed every day.
You'll find that there are restaurants out there that say they're older, but some of them have closed, some have moved locations. We're the only restaurant that's been in the same exact spot and been opening since then, continuously.
And since the restaurant first opened its doors in 1826, the menu has changed only slightly. Lobsters are delivered fresh to the Oyster House kitchen every morning. Di Fronzo places them in a special aquarium where they await their fate.
See, he can't get you because your hand's behind.
Yeah, but he's ready.
And these little guys right here can't get you because you're holding like that. Yeah. Got a good grip? You got him? There you go.
Mama! Oh, my God!
Many celebrities and even presidents have come to the Union Oyster House to enjoy lobster and other popular items. Before moving to Washington, the late President John F. Kennedy was a regular at Table 18. And former President Barack Obama, who came here 3 years ago, loved the clam chowder, one of the restaurant's specialties. Di Fronzo uses old-time tested recipes. So the clam chowder here is made according to New England tradition, with cream and not tomatoes, like it's done in New York. Di Fronzo considers that culinary savagery.
No. It's got it. This is clam chowder. The other one, and again, why do they add tomatoes? You know, it could have been the fact that there may have been more tomatoes available in the area and cream was harder to get, and so tomatoes became an incorporated ingredient. That would be my best guess.
And the chef brushes off any concerns about competition because he knows there is no other place like the Union Oyster House in Boston. Karina Bafragian for VOA News, Boston, Massachusetts.
I love that New England clam chowder. Well, that is our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.